From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the dilemmas in the de-Bethification of Iraq. We talk with journalist Elizabeth Rubin. In this week's New York Times Magazine, she wrote about an Iraqi architect who worked for Saddam Hussein but never joined the Ba'ath Party. We'll also talk with Rubin about her experiences as a Jewish woman covering Islamic countries. Also, we talk with Peter Steinfels. He writes the religion column for the New York Times called Beliefs. His new book is called A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. China's first manned spacecraft has landed safely after orbiting the Earth 14 times. Chinese state television says the astronaut has emerged from the capsule. Officials in New York City said at least 10 people died and dozens were injured when a ferry slammed into pilings on a pier at Staten Island today. The ferry was arriving from Manhattan. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg rushed to the scene and talked about what is known.
What apparently happened is people who were sitting there as the ferry docked were hit by the pilings that came through the side of the boat. We don't know any more than that, and we're not going to speculate on what happened.
The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating. A team of FBI officials leaves for Israel today to investigate the roadside bombing in the Gaza Strip that killed three Americans. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
U.S. Ambassador to Israel Dan Kurtzer said the American officials were on their way to Gaza to interview candidates for Fulbright scholarships in the U.S. He said the three dead were security men from a private company accompanying the convoy. It was the first deadly attack on American officials since the beginning of the Israeli-Palestinian violence 3 years ago. Israel Radio reported a bomb exploded next to an American convoy in Gaza 3 months ago, but there were no injuries. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat called today's attack an ugly crime and said he had ordered an investigation. The U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv advised all Americans to leave Gaza. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In Massachusetts, a federal court judge is now considering whether federal investigators have cause to charge a Guantanamo Bay translator. The translator was arrested at Boston's Logan Airport last month while carrying classified documents. Audie Cornish reports from member station WBUR.
The lawyer for Ahmed Fathi Mahalba says his client had access to classified material while working as a civilian translator at Guantanamo Bay. But attorney Michael Andrews says that doesn't mean Mahalba lied to federal agents when he was arrested last month with a CD containing classified defense files.
The only issue before the court was, did he knowingly make a false statement? Not whether he had classified information or not. His position is he didn't knowingly make a false statement. It turned out to be false. He didn't know it was when he made it.
Federal prosecutors say Mahalba signed several non-disclosure agreements with U.S. officials in Guantanamo and would not have permission to carry such files. Federal Judge Charles Swarthood will rule on the criminal complaint this week. For NPR News, I'm Audie Cornish in Boston.
Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average finished down nearly 10 points at 98.03. Trading was active at nearly 1.5 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed down 4 points at 19.39, and the Standard & Poor's 500 was down 2 points at 10.46. This is NPR News. On his first full day in office, Liberia's new head of state has pledged to tackle the rampant corruption that has plagued the West African nation for decades. NPR's Jason Bobien reports from Monrovia.
The leader of the new transitional government in Liberia, Jude Bryant, says he will have a zero-tolerance policy on corruption and bribery. Pillaging has been so pervasive in Liberia that at his inauguration, Bryant asked people to stand up if they're opposed to looting. Under former President Charles Taylor, civil servants came to expect bribes and kickbacks because they often weren't paid by the government. Bryant says he'll overhaul this culture of corruption by example.
You know, in Liberia, we say the fish gets rotten from the head. And if this head stays fresh, the body's not going to get rotten. I can assure you that.
Bryant says corruption has crippled the Liberian economy and turned the country into one of the poorest in the world. Jason Bobien, NPR News, Monrovia.
Federal officials today recommended flu shots for children from 6 to 23 months old. Before, they had only encouraged the vaccinations. The Centers for Disease Control and the Prevention Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices approved the change. The new recommendation goes into effect in the fall of next year. Strikes continue to inconvenience hundreds of thousands of Californians. Los Angeles Metropolitan Transportation Authority mechanics have stopped the country's third-largest mass transit system for a second day. 70,000 grocery clerks are on strike against Ralph's, Vons, and Albertsons supermarkets in Central and Southern California. And more than 200 of the 343 Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies who provide security at jails have called in sick. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, offering accredited online bachelor's, master's, and PhD programs. Capella University at capella.edu.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is journalist Elizabeth Rubin. She's reported from Iraq, Iran, the Middle East, Uganda, Chechnya, and Bosnia. She's profiled people and covered stories that haven't been covered much, if they've been covered at all. She visited the camp of a militant Iranian opposition group run mostly by women, women who take vows of celibacy. She profiled an Iraqi boy band that had to write a song in praise of Saddam Hussein in order to get their own love song played on Iraqi radio. And she profiled a Hamas military leader who masterminded suicide bombings and was killed by Israeli soldiers. Rubin's work is most often published in The Atlantic, The New Republic, and The New York Times Magazine. This week, The Times Magazine published her profile of an Iraqi architect who had to compromise his political beliefs to stay employed in the Saddam Hussein era. He built palaces and homes for Saddam Hussein and his circle. I asked how that architect, Mofaq Altay, came to work for Saddam Hussein's presidential engineering office.
After 79, when Saddam came to power, part of the process of Baathifying the country was to bring the Ba'ath ideology into the universities. All the professors should be Ba'athists, and especially in something like architecture, which Saddam was obsessed by, which a lot of dictators seem to be. And so to teach architecture and to be encouraging debate, which he did amongst his students, was seen as very provocative and very dangerous for him. He had a friend who was a dean at another university and was a very high-ranking Ba'athist, an old-time Ba'athist, who suggested to him, after a report was filed against him, that he get out of the university before things go wrong. Many ministers had already been executed at that point, and so he was offered a job working in the marshes in the south. This was before the marshes were dried out by Saddam. And the project was to build new sort of homes for the marsh people in the south. And he said yes, he went down there, he loved it. But once he did that, he became part of the presidential engineering offices, and one job led to the next.
You said that in the early 80s, Iraq was a dream for architects, and because there was money to build grand buildings, there were architects from around the world who came there to work on those buildings. Can you talk a little bit about the 80s and architecture in Iraq?
Well, as I said, Saddam was quite obsessed by architecture and by the idea of building a what would become the center of the Middle East. He imagined himself as replacing the Shah of Iran, especially in his relations with the U.S., and architecture is a way of refashioning your capital, your country, in your vision. And that meant creating wide boulevards. It meant creating huge buildings. Also, there was going to be the non-aligned conference. So all of the non-aligned leaders would be coming to Baghdad in 82. And so there was just an enormous amount of building going on in preparation for that. Hotels, skyrises, malls, highways, monuments. And people like Robert Venturi, other architects like Richard England. Previously, Le Corbusier and Gropius had been involved in building Baghdad, but that was in the 60s. And it was seen as a really great opportunity for a generation of architects. It was around 1982. Saddam had the idea to build a great mosque that would rival the great mosque in Morocco and in Kuwait. And he had a competition in which a lot of international architects took part, one of them being Venturi. And this was, you know, at that time, nobody really saw Saddam as something to be avoided, you know, that you would be tainted by building in Baghdad. And so for a young architect like Mofak at the time, you know, he has the opportunity to work with all these internationally renowned artists. It's a dream of a lifetime, and I don't think he thought twice about it.
Is this architect now seen as something of an outcast in the new Iraq because he had worked in the president's, you know, architecture office?
Actually, no. There are some people, and particularly a certain segment of the exiles, who were radicalized and feel that their lives have been really destroyed by having to leave the country, by losing a lot of members of their families, who look at somebody like that as a collaborator. But for the people who stayed in Iraq, and even those who did not partake, you know, didn't have jobs in the president's office, they understand much more what it meant to try to survive under that regime and what you had to do. People who've lived there, who never left, really understand those nuances.
Now, the architect you wrote about managed to work for Saddam's engineering office without joining Saddam's Ba'ath party. But one of the things going on now in Iraq is the de-Ba'athification of Iraq. Would you explain what that program's about?
Sure. The Ba'ath Party was a hierarchical party, and it was structured on ranks. So when Bremer came in, Paul Bremer, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, he decided to fire the top four ranks from any public office. And if anybody had, or let's say a professor was fired, the professor or his students could submit a petition, and Bremer would review it. There were several petitions, and I think some of them, the professors were allowed to stay in their positions. But in general, the top four ranks were fired. And in a way, it had to be done, because you have to show some kind of change, and you have to show the people who were on the outside of the Ba'ath Party that there was a recognition of those people who didn't join the Ba'ath Party, that they were going to become part of the new government and will have a chance to participate in a way that they couldn't because they were not members. But what's happened is you've really isolated, alienated, and infuriated the Ba'ath Party members, many of whom could easily have been brought in to the new dispensation, if you like. And, you know, as this architect actually said to me, who knows the Ba'athists very well, though he was not one of them, he said it's very simple for them to slip over a very seemingly secular man, intellectual Ba'athist, to slip over into the Wahhabist camp now because of tribal unities between the Sunnis, because of a need for an affiliation, and because of anger.
And the Wahhabi a branch of Islam is a more extreme branch.
It is a more extreme branch, and it has certain tenets about it, one of which is evangelizing, another is this sort of pure form of going back to Islam, you know, in the time of the Prophet, which many of these intellectuals wouldn't do in their own lives. However, that alliance, you know, a lot of times, particularly the Bush administration, has talked about the Ba'athists being the secular intellectual group that quite distinct from the religious groups. And in a situation like this, when you have a common enemy, that's going to change, and the lines shift.
Mofak Altay, the architect you profiled, is now teaching. What place does he see for himself in the rebuilding of Iraq?
Well, as I think he points out in the article, he's kind of biding his time right now. He doesn't know what this new government's going to be like. He's not going to get involved with, you know, hitch himself to a new government that he may end up not liking. He has enough money right now that he can support himself. He has orchards. And he will be involved in a project that Kanan Makia, who is an Iraqi author and was in exile for a long time, has started called the Memory Project, which is a a museum dedicated to telling the story of Ba'athist Iraq from 68 to 2003. And that is going to be on the old parade grounds that Saddam had built, called the Crossed Swords Victory Arch. They're these massive swords. I think they're about 40 meters high. They cross, and the forearms and hands were made out of casts of Saddam's forearms and hands. And that's where the military parades used to be. And so somebody like Mofak is incredibly useful because he knows a lot about Saddam's ideas of architecture. And so he'll be involved in that. For example, he will probably do some private architecture. He may consult with the engineering offices that the Americans have set up in order to start reconstructing some of the destroyed palaces and villas. But I think for the most part, he's happy to be teaching again. He's happy to be with his students again, to talk freely. He can say whatever he wants for the first time. And so I think he's just waiting to see what happens.
What does Mofak Altay think of the U.S. occupation?
That's a good question. He's fuzzy on it. No, there's not a single Iraqi who likes seeing American tanks in their city. Nobody does. They don't like seeing American soldiers. They don't like having to stop for them. And it's really difficult. The one thing he said about it that was definitive is, thank God this internal war has also ended. And he meant that psychic split between knowing that what you're doing is morally wrong and not being able to stop because of all the practicalities of surviving in life. And for that, he's just glad it's over.
My guest is journalist Elizabeth Rubin. Her article about the Iraqi architect was published in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Elizabeth Rubin. She's reported from Iraq, Iran, the Middle East, and Chechnya for such publications as The Atlantic, The New Republic, and The New York Times Magazine. Do you think it's much different for a woman war correspondent than it is for a man?
Yeah, it has to be. I mean, people react to you differently. People ask you different questions, treat you differently. In many cases, men who might be a little bit threatened by a male correspondent will be a little bit, you know, more softer and kind of even want to show off in front of women and will tell them things that maybe they wouldn't tell a male correspondent. On the other hand, with men, there's a bonding that sometimes happens that doesn't happen with a woman because, you know, there's a fear of stepping over a line. And so in some ways, I think women have an advantage, especially in Islamic countries where, for example, you can go and stay in the women's side of the house and really see a completely different side of life that you don't see on the streets. And men can't do that.
Can you tell us something that you learned by being able to stay on the women's side of the house?
Well, for example, in Afghanistan, in a place just north of Kabul during the war, I was sleeping with the women and a couple of the male cousins, and they all stay in the same room. And, you know, there's a lot more talk about sex than you think because of the burqa. You know, you think everything is so repressed, and they make a lot of sexual jokes. There's a lot of incredible bonding and closeness between male and female members of the same family. They literally sleep almost on top of each other. And sometimes they're up through the night making jokes. And you see a wedding, which you can't see outside. And these weddings are very surreal. I mean, the women wear every color makeup you could find they put on their face. Some of them color their hair green. They wear yellow dresses. And the two have to sit, the bridesmaid and the bride will sit still on these chairs. They don't move. And the other women come up and dance for them. They have like a tambourine-type drum. And there'll be one woman who sings, one who dances, and one plays the drum. And they're sort of seducing the bride. And it's really, it's quite beautiful and very, very different. You just never would see that if you were a man. In fact, I was with a male reporter who couldn't come. He had to stay on the men's side of the house.
Did you hear any discussion about women's rights or any expressions of discontent about their lack of equality?
Of course. I mean, you know, it varies greatly depending on the level of education. A lot of women in southern Afghanistan, in some of the Pashtun areas, they don't want to work. They don't want to leave the house. They're shy. They prefer life the way it is. I met this woman who was just incredibly courageous. She was a Tajik from Kabul. That means from the Farsi-speaking part of Afghanistan, and it means they were hated by the people in the south who were the Pashtun and the Taliban, right? The Taliban came out of the Pashtun. She was teaching in a school in the south, in the desert, and this was right after the Taliban fell. She started up a school again. It was getting threats, grenades. The Taliban were telling her husband they were going to kill her, so she closed the school. And then the day that I met her, she said, you know, but I just decided yesterday. I mean, they're fighting for what they believe in, so why don't we fight for what we believe in? You know, and if we get killed, well, we're fighting for what we believe in. Otherwise, they've already won. You know, so she went back the next day and opened up the school. And there are women like that all over the country that are just, they're just so courageous and so... they don't want to let this opportunity go. It's really difficult, though, obviously.
What's it been like for you to work in countries where women are truly the other, you know, where women don't have equality, where women aren't even expected to go out of the house without a man escorting them? And you often, have to follow some of those rules. I'm sure you often have to, you know, cover your head, cover your body when you're working, say, in Iran. Has that really made you think a lot about being a woman in a way that you hadn't thought about it before?
You know, it's funny. Iran is different than Afghanistan, Pakistan, because Iran is really, yes, you have to wear a scarf on your head, but, you know, you should see what people are wearing now. They're wearing pink rain jackets just below just above their knee. They're really pushing the limit of the veil and all of this. So Iran is a very different story. But in these other countries, in Afghanistan, you know, one time I was with a commander and some of his men in the mountains, and we came across this nomad family. And this woman was looking at me, and she was slightly afraid, and she was looking at me strangely. And so she asked the commander, his name was Rouhani, you know, what is this? What kind of, is she a witch? What kind of woman is out with men in these parts? You know, what is she doing with you? And he said, no, don't worry, auntie. She's just like us. She's a Western woman. She's like a man. And that's really how they view us. We are these weird sort of hermaphrodites, or I don't know what to call it, but we don't fit into their categories. So we are this other thing that is part man, part woman. And that's how they explain it to themselves. And that's how we get away with being able to pass back and forth between the men's world and the women's world. So there's a privilege there. As a Western woman, you're not treated the same way.
What was your riskiest moment reporting from a war zone?
Let's just take Iraq, which shouldn't have been particularly risky because I was in northern Iraq in Kurdistan, and the war didn't really happen there, except it sort of did. There was a group called Ansar Islam, which was an extremist group up in the north near the border with Iran, and the Americans had sent missiles into the bases of a more moderate Islamic group in Kurdistan, and killed many, many people, 70 people in one house. And they were furious. They were, you know, ready for revenge. They were stunned. And so we went to visit them, but not going into their village. We were on the outskirts, at the crossroads where they were coming out of the village to flee, afraid of another night of bombing. And at this crossroads, we were talking to people who were describing what had happened, and there was a real sense of, like, something is wrong. Something feels funny. People were in a frantic rush. Some Al Jazeera reporter came out and said to a photographer I was with, you know, get out of here. And so there were some other journalists there as well, and they got in their cars and left. And me and my photographer, we were always kind of a bit disorganized, and we weren't sure where we were going to go next. We were sitting and got in the car, and this huge explosion went off behind us. And it had been a suicide bomber who came and in a car and blew himself up right at the crossroads where the Kurdish fighters were gathered. And our driver just went tearing off. And then there were numerous cars passing us with people who'd been, you know, their heads were open and people had lost limbs. And I mean, it was awful. And at the end of this, we were at the hospital, which was down the road, and all these people were being brought in. At the very end, this Australian guy comes in covered in blood. He's shaking and looking around for a foreigner who might have a satellite phone. So I gave him my phone, and he called his friend's wife. At this point, I didn't know what had happened. And he got an answering machine. He couldn't leave a message. He found another friend, and he said, Paul's dead. And we were trying to figure out what had happened because we didn't see any other journalists there. And then this taxi comes up and up to the door of the hospital, opens up the trunk, and there's just a completely unidentifiable body. And it was this journalist, Australian journalist. And it was just, it was really awful. He had a wife and little kid, and it was incredibly sad.
And that doesn't make you, like, second guess your work?
Of course it does. You think every day, what am I doing? But until Afghanistan, things had been in. I had been going to places where the war wasn't that immediate. You know, sometimes it would be post-conflict, or a place that's in a kind of permanent state of conflict where it's not that intense. And so, yeah, in Iraq, I certainly felt at times like, all right, this is enough.
Journalist Elizabeth Rubin will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Perennial, publisher of Sandy Koufax, A Lefty's Legacy, Jane Levy's Story of the Hall of Fame Pitcher, available in paperback, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with journalist Elizabeth Rubin about her experiences as a Jewish woman reporting from Islamic countries. And we talk about the transformation taking place in the Catholic Church with Peter Steinfels. He writes the Beliefs column for the New York Times and is the author of the new book, A People Adrift. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Elizabeth Rubin. She's reported from some of the more dangerous places in the world, including Iraq, Iran, the Middle East, Chechnya, and Uganda. Her articles have been published in the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, and The Atlantic. Excuse me if this is presumptuous, but because your last name is Rubin, I'm assuming there's a good chance that you're Jewish. If that is the case, has it been difficult for you ever to work in certain countries that don't look kindly on Jews, that see Jews as often part of, you know, like international conspiracies and so
yes.
on?
Yes, mm-hmm. It's of course it's difficult. Ironically, it's much easier in Palestine because they have so much experience with the Israelis, and so there's a familiarity. Whereas in a place like Pakistan, to give you an example, where for them Jews have horns, you know, and tails, many of them have never seen or met a Jew. As far as they're concerned, all Jews are Hasidim, and you know, with the long curls and the black hats. And one time I was meeting with a Kashmiri militant in January of 2002. This was just shortly before Danny Pearl went missing. And we were having a conversation about religion. And he was a Shia. He was a very educated guy. And he asked me if I believed in God. And, you know, I had just come from Afghanistan, and I was very kind of, you never know what you're going to answer. I don't have a pat answer for these things. And asked me what my religion was. And for some reason, I just decided that day I'm not going to hide it. I just don't feel like it today. And so I said, well, I'm Jewish. And he froze. He said nothing for literally a minute. And he said, I've always wanted to meet an extremist Jew. And I've always wanted to have email correspondence with an extremist Jew and talk about all these issues and talk about how many Jews were in Israel when in 1948 and you know, and about Zionism and would you do that? And you know, and he started to ask some questions. I said, look, we'd have to start really from scratch because and it was so clear from the questions he was asking that he was starting from a place of fantasy. But then he said to me, look, you're about to go to Kashmir. I was going to Kashmir and the Pakistani side of Kashmir. And he said, please promise me you will never tell another soul in this country that you are Jewish, because we are trained in the jihadi camps to kill Jews. You are the enemy. And he was very serious, and he called a friend of mine who had set up the meeting, telling him to tell me. And, of course, I never did again.
You never told anybody you were Jewish again?
Not in Pakistan, no. And I, in a way, was probably foolish to have done it with him.
So if you stopped telling people in Pakistan that you were Jewish,
yeah,
what would you tell people who asked what your religion is?
Well, one time I was in a women's madrasa, and this young woman who was very, very religious, we were sitting on her bed in her room in the back, and her sister taught at the madrasa, and she said, she was showing me some of her books, and she said, what is your religion? And I said, oh, you know, it's mixed, and just a little bit of everything. There's some Islam, Christianity, Judaism, all of it, you know, that's what happens in America, a lot of intermarriage. But I don't really have religion. And she said, she looked at me and she said, you don't have religion? Don't you feel like a rolling stone? And I said, yes, of course you feel like a rolling stone. That's what we are, you know. And it was just such a beautiful way of phrasing what religion did for her, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it often provoked interesting responses from people. And so I started to just say, you know, I don't follow organized religion. I believe in a sort of personal God.
You know, I've heard some people say that extremists, you know, like religious extremists will often have more respect for someone of another faith than they will for someone who says that they don't have faith, even if it's a faith that they oppose, because at least there's faith there. Have you found that not to be true?
Yes. In the case of this Kashmiri militant, it was absolutely true. He said that I was the first journalist that he'd encountered who talked about God, that most of them that he'd met, you know, he hadn't met that many, were sort of avowed atheists, and that therefore there was a a place to begin a conversation for him. And they will talk about people of the book, you know, and that Allah has, in the Quran, it says to respect people of the book, to be hospitable to people of the book. They are not this way, for example, with Hindus. So it depends on the faith.
Do you think it's riskier for you as a freelance writer? Because you, as a freelancer, you don't have like one organization who's absolutely looking out for you and willing to pull strings and go to bat for you if, you know, if God forbid you were kidnapped or something happened. You might not even get health benefits. You're a freelancer.
Yeah, although I had gone on contract for the New Republic and they were very much behind me.
Uh-huh.
And the New York Times also, because of this, the scale of the war and everything, they also had wanted to send me to, you know, a chemical weapons training course and in case of a chemical attack. And in fact, they both, you know, those sorts of organizations really did rally and were very safety conscious. And I didn't feel kind of like a, you know, a Rolling Stone.
Do you have health benefits?
Yes, I do. There is a war coverage you can get that's actually not that expensive, called SOS.
Oh, so you have like special war coverage health benefits?
Yeah.
And in the States, are you covered?
In the States, I have regular health insurance, like other people do.
But I mean, as a freelancer, do you have to pay for it yourself?
Yes. How that works is I belong to the National Writers Union, and so they have an insurance policy.
Now, one other thing about your writing. You tend to profile people or to just write about one group. You're looking for very specific individual stories within the larger story of the war that you're covering. Now, you're not a daily journalist where you have to cover like a day-to-day unfolding story. Why do you prefer this approach to, you know, profiling a group or a person?
I guess I feel like you can get deeper into questions of character, questions of psychology, of motivation, of why we do the things we do, how we do them. I also feel that for readers, it's very important that you can really identify or think about a character in a situation, and it brings them much closer to the conflicts, which are often, you know, very far away and they don't really care about. And up until September 11th, people didn't really care about these places. So you had to draw them in some other way. And just, I just felt, you know, my temperament isn't really much of a daily reporter just because I'm not that fast. But I just find that the experience for the reader is more gratifying as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Journalist Elizabeth Rubin has written for the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, and The Atlantic. Coming up, Peter Steinfels, author of the new book, A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. This is Fresh Air. The Catholic Church is celebrating the 25th anniversary of the office of Pope John Paul II. My guest Peter Steinfels has written a new book about the American Catholic Church. He says it's in crisis. That's the subject of his new book, A People Adrift. Steinfels is the former senior religion correspondent for the New York Times. He now writes the Times religion column, Beliefs. You write in your book that today the church is on the verge of either an irreversible decline or a thorough transformation. Why do you think one or the other is inevitable?
Well, I think a transformation is underway already. And whether that transformation will be a success or whether it won't be will depend on the, if you will, thoroughness with which the leadership of the church can deal with this. The transformation that's already underway is a transformation, first of all, in leadership. It's a change from leadership primarily by priests and sisters or nuns, women in religious orders, to lay people. The second transformation that's already underway is a transformation in generations. It's a change from Catholics who grew up in a often very highly defined, ethnically rooted Catholicism from before the days of the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s, to Catholics who grew up in the post-conciliar era, which was an era of a often free-ranging, wide-open, sometimes poorly defined or uncertain Catholicism. Those are two changes. That second generation group is moving into leadership positions now in all kinds of Catholic institutions, from parishes right up to Catholic higher education and healthcare and so on. And those two changes are coming together. And they're coming together at a time when, in my view, the church also has to face two massive historical changes, which are outside the church, and they have to do with human sexuality and the role of women. So all these things are converging, and therefore what I'm writing about is really the kind of issues and decisions that Catholics and Catholic leadership have to make in the next 10, 12 years or so if they're going to successfully negotiate the maelstrom, if you will, of all this coming together.
So you think that the sex abuse scandal might actually distract the church from addressing larger issues that it faces? Not that the sex abuse scandal isn't very large and very important.
I think you've stated that correctly. I think that that has to be faced and dealt with. That has to be related to the larger questions in the church. But there are some larger questions that I think would be unsuccessfully dealt with if they were done through this filter. Just let me give you an example. The new Archbishop of Boston, Archbishop O'Malley, who seems to be having some success in dealing with the overhang of the sex abuse scandals there, which were really the center of the, certainly at least the media attention. But we have to remember he's going to be Archbishop and probably Cardinal of Boston for a long, long time, with role in the leadership of the American Church facing all sorts of other theological and church issues, and he'll be an elector for the Pope for until he's 80 years old, and he's a man in his mid to late 50s right now. So we could be in trouble if we looked at everything through the filter of this one, admittedly, very serious issue.
What are some of the questions that you think the church needs to be addressing beyond sexual abuse?
Oh, well, it certainly has to address, above all, the question of leadership. As I suggested, you have this replacement of priests and sisters throughout Catholic institutions by lay people. There are currently some 30,000 lay pastoral ministers who are working in parishes and dioceses doing the kind of things that priests and sisters used to do. Now, that's more than actually the number of active priests in approximately 19,000 American parishes. Those people are doing that, from studies that have been made, out of a sense of commitment. It's not just a neighborhood job for them. It's a sense that they have of a calling from God, and they want to do this lifelong. Well, in a sense, their status in the church is still undetermined. Who looks at their training, their credentials? Who, if you will, exercises quality control? Who will make sure that they are the best people and not kind of middle-range people? Who is choosing them for roles in parishes? How are they going to be collaborated with? Where do they fit in? This is a major development, which is kind of happening under the radar, and that's one example of the sort of thing that has to be looked at, and it will have implications for two areas that I stress a lot. One is the quality of worship on Sunday, which, quite frankly, I think may be more significant for the future of American Catholicism than the issues of what happens in the bedroom, which are so focused upon. And the other is the quality of religious education. How will the faith be passed on to younger generations?
The Catholic service was changed a lot after Vatican II in the late 60s. Do you think it's time to change the service again?
The liturgy on Sunday went through major changes, which, as I suggest in the book, are not a fundamental break with the past, but they do alter, they nuance, they affect the way we think about God and we think about the church. Just having the altar turned around and the priest facing the people has a much more communal sense that, you know, God is within the congregation as well as above and beyond it. And this is all very important. Now, I think there's general agreement that some serious course correction or fine-tuning was needed. A lot of the translations of the Mass and of the prayers that were all in Latin were made rather quickly in the years after the Second Vatican Council, and the Church has already been in the process of redoing that. But this has become an area, unfortunately, of very polarized reactions. So that's another theme I'm trying to develop. Let's stop the polarization, which is creating a kind of ecclesiastical church gridlock, and focus on some of these empirical, practical, grassroots questions. And the same goes for religious education.
Several of the big controversies within the Catholic Church revolve around issues of sex, celibacy, and gender. And you connect several of those relevant issues to the 1968 papal document, the Humanae Vitae?
Humanae Vitae, yes.
Explain what that document was.
Well, at the time of the Second Vatican Council, and actually starting a little bit before, partly because of the development of the birth control pill, there was a revisiting of the Church's prohibition on, and condemnation of the use of contraception, and this revisioning was revisiting was pretty significant. There was a papal commission set up. It was expanded, and this went on for years. And that papal commission really did reach a majority decision, which was submitted to the Pope, in this case Pope Paul VI, arguing that the Church really should revise its teaching and should no longer have the kind of blanket condemnation of contraception that it had held. And in 1968, after a prolonged consideration of the Commission's work, Pope Paul VI reaffirmed the condemnation of contraception in this encyclical Humanae Vitae. And I say in my book that this has really proved to be kind of the Vietnam War of the Catholic Church. It has gone on and on and on. Ultimately, what's happened, the biggest issue, is that it's undermined the authority of the Church, because people unconvinced by the arguments in this area tend to think that, you know, a lot of wisdom that I think the Church has in that area just is dismissed, and that's made the Church's ability to, say, make its case regarding abortion much harder. It's had an effect overall, I think, of kind of privatizing Catholics' judgments about moral issues rather than really trying certainly to make up their own mind, but to do that in a serious consultation with the tradition and informing themselves. I think more and more Catholics in more and more areas just kind of say, well, you know, I do my own thing, and I don't take the teaching of the Church even to be seriously examined and considered.
My guest is Peter Steinfels, author of the new book, A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Peter Steinfels, writes the New York Times religion column, Beliefs. His new book is called A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. I'm always interested in people's reasons for staying within their religion when they have deep differences with the way the religion is practiced at the moment or with the hierarchy of the religion. Why do you stay in the Catholic Church in spite of your many disagreements with it?
Well, I think I stay in the Catholic Church, first of all, because I believe it's true, and I don't think you can get around that. I don't believe it's true in the sense that I think that there's no truth, no religious truth outside the Catholic Church. There clearly is, and one of the great things about the years I spent as a religion reporter at the New York Times was the ability to have firsthand contact with a lot of different faith groups. But I do think that the Catholic Church has a fullness of truth, which I don't find elsewhere, and that those focus both in doctrine and especially in the sacramental life of the Church, in its round of its cycles of worship, of prayer, and especially in the Sunday Eucharist. And so I think those are the two things. I think, you know, a part that some Catholics stress is the role of the Pope, and it is a distinctive element. And I do, you know, include what gets called as the Petrine ministry, the ministry of Peter and his successors, as something that unifies the Church and does keep it on some kind of a common course. I do find that a valuable thing, although I don't quite find it the absolute center that some of my fellow Catholics do.
Do you go to church every Sunday?
I do.
What do you find most valuable to you about participating in the service?
I think it's the mixture of encountering God through Jesus in both the readings in Scripture and then particularly in the Eucharistic celebration, the reception of the transformed bread and wine, together with the whole mixture of people that come together that are all types, and sinners and saints and so on.
And what would you most like to change as you sit in church every Sunday about the service itself?
I think that I would like to have a stronger sense of congregational unity in our singing together, and I think I would like, sometimes I find other things to do during the homilies or sermons, and I know I'm going to be in big trouble with my pastor for saying that.
Well, and when you talk about the singing, do you think the songs need to be better?
I think that singing was never recognized, and music as really essential to the Catholic worship. It was kind of an add-on, and we do have great music in our parish, and we have a choir that draws on the heritage of sacred music. But sometimes the congregational singing, quite frankly, I have my views on what I like and don't like, but I wish people would just worry more about, you know, what works, what makes people open their mouths and join with their neighbors. As St. Augustine said, you know, the person who's praying in song prays twice. And I think we ought to be very much more practical about that.
Peter Steinfels, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Steinfels' new book is called A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. He writes the New York Times religion column called Beliefs. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osman's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, publisher of Sickened, the memoir of a Munchausen by proxy childhood by Julie Gregory. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence Shames and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young. At bookstores everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Earl Scruggs. He developed the staccato three-finger, five-string banjo technique that's become the standard of bluegrass. He co-wrote Foggy Mountain Breakdown, one of the first crossover hits in bluegrass. Scruggs is featured on the CD The Three Pickers with Doc Watson and Ricky Skaggs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.